By now, most, if not all of you, know about the approaching death of Sports Illustrated. And as a guy who wrote for the magazine from 1996 to 2003, I want to explain why, for those who work there, it's different. So, to be a part of the Sports Illustrated staff wasn't just to be a part of, I don't know, the Tennessean or Newsday, other places I worked. It was bigger, grander. You were surrounded by these all-time great journalists working in the shadows of names like DeFord and Jenkins and Plimpton and Murray. You felt as if you were on the all-star team. You felt as if what you wrote mattered. Athletes greeted you, awaited you. They wanted to be in Sports Illustrated. They longed for a cover story. You were expected to write at a high level. You were expected to uncover details that no one else out there found. You were paid very well and treated like royalty. Fancy hotels, enormous per diems. It was journalism practice at the highest level imaginable, and to be a part of it, even a small part of it, was Christmas and Easter combined. So, to see what's happening, to see corporate greed take apart the final pieces of a storied journalistic outpost, well, it's not all that different from witnessing the death of a loved one. For me, Sports Illustrated wasn't just a place to work or a thing to read. It was a dream. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Mark Mulvoy, who started writing for Sports Illustrated in 1965 and ultimately became the greatest and most influential managing editor in the magazine's lengthy history. This is episode number 348. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks, and your face looks like a bowl of cereal that's been left in the sun for too long.
All right. Well, Mark Mulvoy, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. And I just want to say, when I arrived at Sports Illustrated, I arrived in 1996, shortly after you left. I got there and SI was the dream. It was the sports mecca. It was one of the true great magazines on the planet. And I feel like in the wake of what's sort of happened and been announced, I have to start by asking you, how do you feel about this all?
Well, sadly, to me, it was inevitable, with what's happened. You know, when Time Inc. did the deal with Meredith quickly get rid of Time Magazine and Fortune, both of which were delivered to people who really made big issues out of them, spent money, invested, and, you know, they've become very good publications. You know, they sort of dumpstered SI to these various, you know, I don't know, quick buck, no money type of operations, Arena and these other things with, I think, flimsy management and everything else. They were bundling everything, and it really had no chance, to be honest with you. I didn't think. I mean, we went from making a couple hundred million dollars a year in, you know, the late 90s to, you know, being bankrupt, no matter any which way you want to look at it. And it's sad. Now, SI was the victim of the internet. Time Inc. across the board didn't get into the internet in the late 90s. The guy who ran Time Inc. at the time called the internet the black hole. And as a result, everybody on the business side up there said, well, if he thinks that it's the black hole, why am I going to spend a lot of time and money, capital, and the whole bit on this thing that he calls the black hole? So by the time they get into the game, it was really too late. And they never found a way to really put a paywall on all their on the great stories that people produced, including yourself.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I ran track and cross country at the University of Delaware just for a year. And about a decade ago, Delaware killed the track and cross country programs. They ended the programs. And I always say to my wife, when something dies like that, it starts to feel like it never existed to begin with. And you kind of wonder whether this thing you had, this joyful experience you had, if it even mattered. As a person who didn't just run SI, but exemplified SI, as you've seen the magazine sort of decline and interest decline and budget decline and corporate greed take over, do you ever have those sort of what the hell happened kind of emotions?
Well, in a way I did, Jeff, but in truth, when I left, I really, you know, I created, I don't know, 500-600 issues of the magazine and was the editor, the publisher. I mean, I was there for 31, ultimately 34 or 5 glorious years. And I've always felt that when you leave something, you leave something, you know. I can't believe some of the people in business who hang around for a second thing. I went out of the building in 1996. I never went back into the building for about 6 years and had no interest in going back. So to me, it was, you know, you lived at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for such a long period of time. Getting away from me, getting away from it was sort of a catharsis in so many ways. It, you know, it was cleansing. At the same time, it's very hard, you know, when you've done something and the way we did it. I mean, we won every award known to journalism for a long period of time. We're off the charts, the number of people who read the magazine, the impact the magazine had. And then it sort of deteriorated nuts. Not, it didn't deteriorate slowly. It deteriorated overnight. They never had the right people. They had the wrong agenda. You know, the swimsuit issue was supposed to be about swimsuit models. It's not supposed to be a political statement and have octogenarian, you know, people on the cover. I mean, that's not what the purpose of the swimsuit issue was. And I think that resonated with the readership. And it was all part of the decline and fall of the great empire. But, you know, the thing that scares me, Jay, and I'm going to digress a little bit here. At Sports Illustrated, you know, when I took over the magazine in 83, I really said to the staff, I wanted us to be the conscience of sport, because television was in bed with everybody. They're in bed with the teams. They're in bed with the leagues. I mean, nobody was doing, quote, journalism. And we had the type of great writers and investigators, the Armin Katayans of the world, who could, you know, could do stories, the Pete Rose stories, the drug menace that pervaded the NFL, the gambling problems, academic abuses in college. You know, we were on top of that. But what's evolved now, I think, in recent years is that, you know, I think it's sort of like Pravda when I really think of it. It's all state-controlled media. You know, the leagues have their websites and they control the dissemination of news. I mean, in the old days when you and I, as when I was writing, I mean, I still have Arnold Palmer's phone number. He's been dead for 6 years. And myself, nobody's ever talked to Tiger Woods. If I would need a court, I'd call Arnold. He'd talk to you. I mean, we had a great rapport. If you wanted to talk to somebody in the old days, you'd call him, you'd meet him, you'd take him out to dinner with him and his wife, maybe. You'd go to the house and watch a football game. I watched the Super Bowl game one time in John Beliveau's den with him. I mean, back in the late 70s, that was the Jets Super Bowl victory. That doesn't happen anymore. The teams control everything. You want to talk to somebody, they bring them out, you ask three questions, and they bring them back to the locker room. Now, it's sort of, I think the end of Sports Illustrated really is the final nail in the coffin of sports journalism, to be very honest with you. And that's the scary part to me.
Did you see a moment when you were running the magazine when this stuff started to slowly change, or do you feel like this all happened after your time there?
I think it all happened after me, because I told them I was going to retire. In 94, I said I'd retire after the Olympics, which I did, you know, 12, 13 years. You know what it's like running a magazine. And I had other things I wanted to do. I was going to be 55, and I had a contract where they paid me for several years, basically not to work. But it happened after that, because the internet was just coming into place at that time. You know, Time Inc. was lost. You know, I look back at the things, too, that were really a death knell at the Time Inc. Back in the mid-80s, Sports Illustrated with Bob Miller as the publisher, we made a pitch to the Time Inc. board. We could have bought 24.5% of ESPN that Getty was trying to get rid of. I mean, every time I see Joe Ripp, who was the CFO of the company, in fact, I'm going to have lunch with him down here in Florida in a couple of weeks, he looks at me and says, why the hell didn't they do that? All I can tell you is that the Hearst bought that. And a good friend of mine, Sean Bratches, was the CFO of ESPN for years. And he'd tell me every year when they'd close the books, he said, well, we made $7.2 billion last year, and we're going to send a check off to Hearst for $1,750,000,000. Can you imagine if Time Inc. had spent like less than $100 million to buy that piece of ESPN? That would have kept that company going even today. But, I mean, that was the short-sightedness, mainly because Jerry Levin at the time, he said, well, we should do everything with the synergy he talked about. We should do this all with HBO. I said to him one day, the problem with HBO is they won't answer our phone calls. And I said, so there's that problem. You can take your synergy and you know what you can do with it. And but why they never let us buy that, it was like the bottom line of Sports Illustrated and a couple of $1 million more. That would have saved that company in perpetuity.
And you know what's sad is through the years, SI would come out with these like half-assed, you know, the website was CNNSportsIllustrated.com. Meanwhile, ESPN had ESPN. We would do CNNSI, the network that offered nothing, you know, like all these half-assed replicas of other people doing stuff better.
Well, you know, we did things. We were so independent. Listen, we made so much money. We had the best talent in the world. And you know, all the writers I'm talking about, the DeFords and the Rileys and Underwood, John Underwood, who just died, and Kerry Kirkpatrick in his glory. I mean, we had the best writing talent in the world, no matter how you looked at it. And we just did things. You know, we were on our own. We basically, the editor of the company at the time, Henry Grunwald, he didn't know sports at all. He just knew that we were making a hell of a lot of money. And, you know, I guarantee you today, if you brought the idea of Sid Finch to somebody, you know, to the editor-in-chief, they'd give you a funny look. We didn't even tell them. I didn't even tell anybody. But six people knew about Sid Finch. You know, and that's still one of the greatest April Fool's story of the history of the world. But we had carte blanche to do things, and nobody bothered us. As a result, the whole world was out there for us to cover, to report on. And that has not been the case, obviously, in recent years. I mean, excuse me, how in God's name, I'm still trying to figure out how they end up picking Deion Sanders as Sportsman of the Year this year. I mean, if you can explain that to me, I mean, first of all, the guy's got all kinds of legal issues in the deep background. And I mean, that's a mystery to me. Why would you do it? I looked at, when we did Sportsman of the Year, I would just tell them that this was our man. I remember one year in 92, as I was leaving to go up to a meeting in Lillehammer for the upcoming Olympics, I got my guys in the office, Peter Carey and Coulson and a couple of guys. I said, we got to come up with the Sportsman boys. And, you know, by the time I come back here, and I said, here's my thoughts, boom, boom, boom. A couple of days later, on the way back from Oslo, I stopped in Paris to see my daughter, who was in school at the time. And we were sitting at a kiosk outside the Galeries Lafayette, and there was a picture of Arthur Ashe on the back of a magazine that I could see as I was having coffee. And I said to my Chrissy, I said, I've come a long way, but there's my Sportsman, because we kicked around. It was sort of a harmonic convergence and went home. Arthur was our Sportsman of the Year that year. I went up, Bill Coulson and I went over to tell him. Arthur was in tears. We had a wonderful celebration for Arthur, and he died a month later. Unbelievable.
Wait, also, like, what's crazy is some of the sportsmen you had are guys you would never, just corporate America wouldn't allow, like Bonnie Blair. There's no way Bonnie Blair, a speed skater in modern days, or even Greg LeMond.
Greg LeMond, when I picked Greg LeMond, I said to guys, I called him and I said, I want to see you. I went out to see him in Minneapolis and we sat down at dinner with his family. And I said, now you and I are going to go to a bar here and have a couple of beers. And I said, I just want you to tell me one thing. I want to know the sensation you felt coming down the Champs-Élysées, having overtaken, I think it was Fillon, you know, in the last 30 miles or whatever it was to take. Yet the French people were going crazy in celebration of you, even though you had, you know, knocked their guy out of the race. And he talked for about 20 minutes of it. It was unbelievable. But you're right, they'd never pick him. Now they pick some team, somebody that makes notes. I mean, I think that when we picked Bonnie Blair, we also picked the guy who's been one of the great humanitarians in the history, the Johan Olav Koss.
Yeah.
You know, the great from, he's from, where was he, Norway or Finland or what have you like that. What he's done in the third world to provide medicine and food and everything to these impoverished people throughout the world. He's a sportsman. You know what I mean? He's not a shooting guard who scored the winning basket somewhere.
There would be no thought, literally zero thought about, we need to market this issue. This issue needs to sell a ton. We need someone who's super famous. We need someone who's going to show up to the event. None of that.
None. So you have to understand, we as a magazine, we had 3,300,000 loyal subscribers. We didn't go out on the newsstand till Wednesday or Thursday, unlike all the other magazines that are out there Monday morning. And as a result, we didn't get vast displays on it. If we sold 100,000 copies, that was fine. That was lucky for me. I could do what I wanted to do on the cover because the cover was that we weren't dependent on a cover image or individual to sell issues. Like People magazine was totally cover oriented. You know what I mean? So we did some, you know, I mean, I just know one of the great covers that I look back yesterday, actually, a day before, I've looked back at a lot of the covers that I created. And I just look at certain ones like One Day in Baseball. You know what I mean? I sent 16 or 18 writers off. One sold hot dogs. One worked the lines with the grounds crew. One of the guys was in the scoreboard at Fenway Park. And they did. One was in the umpire's room, you know, working the mud on the balls and stuff like that. One Day in Baseball. And we had to do it on a Sunday when the Cubs were at home because their old scoreboard had all 16 or 17, and then with 16 games, I guess would be maybe 15, were being played on that particular Sunday. We had all. It was a great cover. They wouldn't do that today. you know, because there's some tie-in. You look at the magazine and the swimsuit issue. I took Kathy Ireland out of the swimsuit issue 1 year because my rule was, ladies, if you're in the swimsuit issue for us, you're in the swimsuit for us. If you're in for an advertisement, you're not going to be in the issue for us. And suddenly at the last minute, an ad appeared worth a couple of $100,000 with Kathy in it. And so I said to our ad people, you take it. Either the ad's out or she's out. I said, you make the call. My rules are simple. And they wanted to keep her in for the money. Well, I had a million pictures of Kathy, of other models. Anyway, I called Kathy and explained to her, and she said to me, I respect what you did. I said, that's the right way to do things. And she wasn't in the issue then. That wouldn't happen this year.
No, the writer Mike Vaccaro, great columnist for the New York Post, posted recently on his Instagram feed a letter he wrote to Sports Illustrated that ran on February 27, 1984. It said, "Sir, I want to thank you on behalf of the entire Chaminade High School basketball team for introducing us to Kathy Ireland. The picture of her in a lacy bikini now hangs proudly in our lockers, replacing that of Larry Bird."
You know, Kathy Ireland's probably a billionaire. She's got her business out there and got a great home design and everything else. She's a wonderful, wonderful first class lady. I mean, look at the models we had. They're all high class, elegant people. You know, I'm sorry. It's a different take these days.
Well, I am interested. Like, what would you say to people who are like, I mean, I know you heard it all the time. You're a sports magazine. You don't write about women that often. And here's this one issue every year where you plaster 80% naked women, you know, and it's just jerk off material for guys. Like, what? Yeah. How did you respond to that back in the day?
Well, I didn't respond too much in the sense that, to me, we did it once a year. The business people would have loved it too if we did it about every other week because of the way it sold. But it was a once a year phenomenon that the American public embraced. I mean, we sold 5-6 million copies on the newsstand. I mean, a few nuns banned it from their libraries at some Catholic schools. I'm Catholic, so I have to watch what I say, but it wasn't a lot. I didn't really defend it. I mean, people, the worst person about it was Dean Smith's wife. What was her name? Laverna, right? And she was out. So I called Dean one day. I really did call him. I said, "Dean, you know, cease or desist." I said, "And what have you like that? This is not a good look for you." I said, "You know, I basically said, you know, maybe we have to do a hard look at the North Carolina basketball program." You know, guess what? We never heard another word from her.
Wow. You alluded to something I have to ask about. April 1st, 1985, the cover of Sports Illustrated was actually the Big East, and it was Chris Mullin, Patrick Ewing, and Dwayne McLean. But inside is one of the most famous articles in the history of the magazine, The Curious Case of Sid Finch, written by George Plimpton. The lead, I just want to read real quick, is, "The secret cannot be kept much longer. Questions are being asked, and sooner rather than later, the New York Mets management will have to produce a statement. It may have started unraveling in St. Petersburg, Florida, 2 weeks ago, on March 14th to be exact, when Mel Stottemeyer, the Mets pitching coach, walked over to the 40-odd Met players during their morning calisthenics at the Payson Field Complex, not far from the Gulf of Mexico, a solitary figure among the pulsation of jumping jacks, and motioned three Mets to step out of the exercise. The three all-good prospects were John Christensen, a 24-year-old outfielder, Dave Cochran, a spare but muscular switch-hitting third baseman, and Lenny Dykstra, a swift center fielder who may be the Mets' leadoff man of the future. Ordering the three to collect their bats and batting helmets, Stottemeyer led the players north end of the complex, where a large canvas enclosure had been constructed 2 weeks before. The rumor was that some irrigation machinery was being installed in an underground pit." And then basically they all go in to face this pitcher, Sid Finch. How did this come to be?
Well, I tell you, when you edit a weekly magazine, you know the date of every issue. Like, and so around Christmas, the first of the year, I was looking at the upcoming year, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's the NCAAs, that's the Super Bowl, that's the this. And it was April 1st. And I said, "Oh my God." I said, "I mean, I've only had the job for a year. I'm not even a year." So I said, "We got to do something April Fool's." And I had these goofy ideas. So I called Myra Gelband, who was my articles editor, who dealt pretty much with George all the time. I said, "We got to get George in here, will you?" So George comes in, the three of us chit chat. I said, "George, I want to do something. I have a hoax story on April Fool's Day. I mean, you know, I've got some thoughts. You've got some thoughts. Think about it. Let's get back in a week or two." This is in January. So 2 weeks later, he comes in. Some idea about a marathoner at the London Marathon runs backward and ends up in Paris or something. I don't know what that was. Some George, I said, "Please, this is America. We got to do something, America. Let's create a fictitious something or other." Huh. He comes back a week later. "I got it. Sid Arthur Finch, I said, he said what he was going to do. I said, you're on your own. A month later, he brings in the story. Only about five people were aware of it, George and Meyer, myself. Then I get, of course, Heinz Klutmeyer and the photo people in. But I guarantee you, when it went to press, there were only about 10 people who knew what was in this particular story. I mean, I have one boss, the editor-in-chief, and the deal I had with him and he had with me, the orders really, were that he didn't want any surprises, you know? And so, you know, this would have been a surprise. This would have been a shock. This would have been something I should have told him about. But to be truthful, I was afraid if I did tell him, he'd say, no, you can't do that. So we did it. And all hell broke loose when we did it. I mean, it was a great story. So great. I mean, the New York papers went nuts because their writers were trying to track this guy down all over St. Petersburg. I mean, who was that? And then the Mets, Frank Cashin really helped because Frank had been a journalist, as you know, in Baltimore with the Sun before he went to the Orioles. So Frank was in on it and made it, you know, he really helped it from here. He loved the idea of really this helping out during spring training. And so that worked. And then it was published, of course. I mean, people were very, very critical right off the bat. You know, how could you internally within the magazine, you know, publisher and people, how could you possibly play around with a reader like that? And I said, listen, I print 600-700 stories a year. If I can't have fun with one of them, I mean, what the hell are we doing? So then on Sunday, George Vesey writes a wonderful Sunday column in the Times commending us and thanking us for bringing some joy and excitement and fun to the world of sports. Then on Monday, the evening news on ABC, what's his name, the Canadian fellow who did the news at that time, he comes on and he says, folks, we always do something on the April Fools, but SI did this week, nobody's going to ever match. So they did, I think, 11 or 12 minutes of prime time on Sid Finch. Then Tuesday, the editor-in-chief comes back. And by now, everything's gone on. Everything's, this is the greatest thing since sliced beef. And, you know, they love what's going on. He comes to me, he says, I should have known when you said that he throws the ball 162 miles an hour, that was a hoax. And I looked at him. Henry was an Austrian. He's later an ambassador to Austria for Reagan. I said, Henry, you don't know whether a fastball goes 162 miles or 2 miles. Or he says, I guess you're right there. He says, but I'm glad you ran it. You know, so it all changed quickly. And I get calls every year around April 1st to talk about Sid Finch. It's an iconic story. George turned it into a book.
To run a magazine, did you have to be fearless? Like, did you have to just be like, fuck it, we are doing blank, we are doing blank? Or was it okay or important to have a little bit of trepidation with decisions?
I think if you have trepidation, you're not an editor. I think if you're an editor and you know, have an idea of what you're doing and what you want to do, if you understand your audience, your readers, if you understand the world of sports, I mean, one of the things you have to do as an editor of a weekly magazine, I mean, I never went to bed without watching SportsCenter at 11 o'clock at night because, you know, who knows what, something might have happened. I mean, remember the night that Mike Tyson gets starched by Buster Douglas? Yeah. I had one photographer there and one writer in Tokyo. I'm watching the fight. I said, oh my God. Then I'm up for 4 hours with my boxing editor and I woke him up and, you know, we got to get film. We got to get this. We got to get another writer. But you can't be, you've got to be fearless. You make mistakes. You know what I mean? And I remember putting Deion Sanders of all people on the cover. Look, and I called it Neon Deion. And I bothered me when I looked at the, I got the first issue of the magazine helicoptered to me, a private to me from the plants every Tuesday. I'd have it by 3 o'clock. And I saw that and I go, oh my God, was this the message I was delivering to the youth of America? This guy with more Neon Deion stuff and jewelry and everything else. It bothered me. But you know, one thing about the magazine, I read the magazine every Tuesday when I'd get it. I never looked at it again. I made the notes that I had to discuss with some people on Wednesday that I really liked better than I thought I might like, or that I had a problem with ultimately for some reason. But we just moved on. You can't live in yesterday when you're doing a magazine.
Wait, interesting follow-up here. I'm looking at the Deion Sanders cover and it says Atlanta's Neon Deion Sanders, primetime live. And it's him with the shirt open, right. Leather right. Jacket, chains all over. And I used to wonder this when I was at SI too, sports and sort of hip hop and young black culture in America all kind of merged together. And Sports Illustrated, when I was there, certainly when you were there, you know, it was a very white, you know, editorial staff and white editors. Do you ever look back and think maybe we not having a more diverse decision-making team hurt in some areas?
We had Roy Johnson, a black editor, that came to us, and so, and we had access to Sonia Steptoe, brought a voice to the magazine and others. But I think that's probably a fair assessment. That, but believe me, we tried. We scoured the landscape, and if you looked at newspapers all over the country, which was basically our resource, they were also pretty much the same way. You know, Roy talked me out of one or two things, and you know, but we had a bunch of young kids too from school, from colleges. And you know, you sit around talking about something, they'd be around and say, well, you know, that's, oh, okay. You know, you're right. You know, it's 55-year-old guys and you're a 22-year-old kid just out of college, you know. Editors were interesting because I think I put Michael on the cover 35 times, you know, and of course I put him on the cover in the baseball cover, you know, Michael. I mean, I knew what was going on. Jerry Reinsdorf was going to bring him to Chicago one weekend, sell up the place, put 190,000 people in the ballpark there, make a fortune, and Michael couldn't hit you or me. And to me, it, you know, he was making light of the game of baseball and the integrity of the game, and I didn't like. That's why I put him on the cover, saying, "Michael, bag it." He hasn't talked to anybody from Sports Illustrated since. You know, I mean, give me a break. Phil Knight, every time I go have lunch with Phil every year in Oregon, and every, he loved what we did with the magazine with his people, you know, whether it's Michael or what have you like that. He understood the baseball cover. It wasn't a problem.
Looking back, I'm staring at that cover. It's Bag It Michael. Steve Wolf wrote the column. The story, interestingly, not that harsh, like a little harsh, but not really harsh. But the cover is fairly harsh.
The cover was me. Wolf, and I know Steve was, the certain writers always try to cover their tracks for future. You know what I mean? Yeah. And but the cover was me. I just, you know, I just knew big picture was going on and I didn't like it.
Was it a mistake to run that cover?
No, I don't think.
Even if it ended the relationship.
That just, to me, showed me more about Michael than people, so much about Michael people ought to know. You know what I mean? He was on the cover 50 times. He made gazillions of dollars with the Gatorades and with the Nikes and everything else. He doesn't like one out of 50. That's 2% of the covers he's been on. Went in and he, you know, throws a, you know, a shit storm forever. I mean, give me, I don't even, he's his golf club down the road here. I mean, I, what can I say?
Before we continue with two writers slinging yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. So how was the K-pop store?
It was pretty great. I bought 2 NCT Dream albums, 3 NCT 127 albums, a Yuta Nakamoto poster, a 1984 Michigan Panthers Anthony Carter jersey, a Jungwoo book, a How to Sing Like Jenny Kim instructional manual, and...
Wait. You bought a 1984 Michigan Panthers Anthony Carter jersey at the K-pop store?
Well, actually, I bought it at RoyalRetros.com, kings of the throwback sports merchandise. But then... all the 13-year-old K-pop fanatics surrounded me and started tearing at the fabric while screaming, "I love you, Doyoung! I love you, Doyoung!" So I opened my own Royal Retros kiosk, and now I'm rich.
This is just too weird.
We K-pop fans never disappoint.
I want to throw some writers at you from your time, because these are guys I did not have the pleasure of working with. And you can kind of just give me your breakdown or sort of a memory of a couple of guys. I never worked with Frank DeFord, which makes me very sad. What can you tell me about DeFord?
Frank was a tremendous, I'll be very blunt, but Frank and I, you know, had a tremendous fallout at the end and over his departure from SI and starting the National, when he went and tried to hire 12 of my people while he was still under contract to us. I mean, it was unfortunate. But Frank was a brilliant writer of long stories. He was a terrible writer of short stories. I mean, the editors at the National would tell you when he'd write those pithy little columns, they'd have to sit down and figure out what he was saying. That's not unusual. Frank, even when he wrote long stories, Jerry Tax was his personal editor for many of the years. He'd write, his lead paragraphs would be a little bit, Jerry would work with him, but he was a brilliant, he took stories in brilliant, brilliant directions. He wrote a story, I forget who it was about, he made it into a play. And I read it, and you know, I thought it was 50-50 whether it was really good or not. But you know what? It was Frank DeFord, and you give it to him. But his stories on Bobby Knight and all the people that wrote, he was brilliant, no question about it.
Did you guys ever get past the National beef?
No. Last time I saw him, I was on an air, he was sitting in row 2B, and I was in row 3B on a flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles in, I don't know, 1998. And then I was on the board of a company. I was coming back from the West Coast.
Right.
And didn't talk on the plane, you know.
Do you think the National could have worked?
No.
How come?
They never did any market research, number one. And he was trying to create a magazine, a daily magazine. Now, they had no distribution channels. You know, we had the bonus piece that, and you wrote so many of them. Well, that's not a daily read. You know, people at the bonus piece of SI, they get the magazine on Thursday, say they read that Saturday afternoon or something like that. And he had one of those, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 word stories in every issue. And secondly, in a lot of cities, you know, in LA, there's no public transportation, people going to work. Like I read the newspapers on the way in from Ride of the City when I was coming in, you know. And if you're in LA, you're riding your car. When do you read it? So the whole distribution setup was tragically flawed to me. I said that at the time that I didn't see that. They were out of business in, 15 months and $75 million or something, and God knows how many careers. I think it was under my – put it this way. Time Inc. did the same thing with TV Cable Week magazine and Hemorrhage Money, and they basically did the same thing with the National.
Dan Jenkins, obviously a legend of legends at SI, maybe considered the greatest writer to ever appear in the pages of SI. What's the scouting report on Dan Jenkins in his prime?
The best. I mean, I know I joined the magazine in 1965. I think as I'm flying to New York, I read his story, Glory Game at Goat Hills, where he had half the people talking backwards and everything. And I said to myself, God, I'm in the wrong league. I mean, he was brilliant. I mean, he covered the first game on AstroTurf. God sure blew it when he gave us grass. You know what I mean? I mean, the guy was brilliant. You know, one time Nicholas wins about his 800th tournament, and he writes his first paragraph. He's an axe murderer. He's a bank robber. He's this. He dropped the bomb on Nagasaki. He said, oh, I'm just trying to say something different about Jack Nicklaus. I mean, the guy was a genius. And he wrote so quickly. You know, people would be agonizing over stories for hours. Dan would sit down, get himself a couple of cups of coffee, and wham, the story was done. He was a brilliant writer, an absolute brilliant writer. And unfortunately, he and my predecessor didn't get along. And Dan left the magazine about a year after I took over. And I tried to get him to come back, but the wounds were too deep. I mean, look what he did. I mean, just the best.
George Plimpton, the author of Sid Finch, one of my favorite books of all time growing up, at least, was Paper Lion. What was Plimpton like?
Plimpton was Plimpton. You know, Plimpton was a Brahmin, maybe not a Brahmin, but he was, he was from the sperm lucky era, I would say. And I say that with a he was just a great, I set him up to play golf for the Boston Bruins. He wrote a book about that. When he was on the golf tour, I was covering the tour and I would work with him, get him with caddies and the whole bit. And the guy, I mean, it's amazing the way what he wrote. I mean, Sid Finch is a classic case. He was great to write with. I'm not going to say he wasn't strange. He threw great parties. What he did with his publication was, you know, unbelievable. George just the nicest guy in the world. And I watched him one night play at the Philharmonic. That was he had something or other. And we had Philharmonic season tickets. And there he was one night playing the flute or something like that. I mean, the guy, God, he was a genius. He was great.
When I was growing up, my favorite writer at SI, because I was a huge boxing guy, was Pat Putnam. And yeah. I have a piece in front of me from 2008 written by the late George Kimball for BoxingTalk.com, reconsidering the late Pat Putnam, because it turns out he lied a lot about about his military background. I don't know. Do I need to reconsider loving the work of Pat Putnam?
You know, Pat was a squirrely guy. I mean, Pat was, you know, he moved from Long Island and moved up to central New York or something like that. You know, everybody liked him. And, you know, how much did he write for me? I'm not sure that he wrote that much for me. Mark Cram was there. Mark was a brilliant writer, you know. And, you know, Pat was, I wouldn't say Pat was a wordsmith. He was a down and dirty writer. You know, he was a 3-page writer. You know, Cram could write 8 pages. It'd take him a year. But, you know, Pat was sort of a reporter writer. You know what I mean? And he was basically the facts. We had a lot of Pats, I thought.
When you were running the show, it would be a mix of writers you guys would have. You'd have someone who would come up through the system and through the bullpen and develop. And then you would get a lot of guys, the Riley types, from different newspapers. How would you scout out writers, and how would you determine when someone is worthwhile of being hired at SI? Like, Riley as an example, like, how do you know a Rick Riley is going to translate, or a Rick Talender, or any of those guys, to SI from a newspaper?
Well, you know, I don't think I ever hired anybody as a writer from journalism school. You know, I wasn't interested in somebody who wrote who, what, where, when, how, and why, and stuff like that. I wanted somebody who was a wordsmith. And, you know, when you see someone will tell you, we had a lot of correspondents around the company and writers who travel. Somebody would say to me, hey, you really ought to read Rick Reilly. And I'd get Larry Keith, who was the one. I said, Larry, let's get a lot of clips from Reilly. And, you know, he'd get a month's worth of clips and some, he'd bring them in. You know, he'd come in and you'd talk to him. And I remember when I hired Alan Shipnick, who was a hell of a writer. I mean, I'm out playing golf at Pebble Beach, and Paul Spangler says to me, I want you to meet this guy. I said, Paul, I meet a million friggin' kids from high school papers who can write. Please just tell them to send one. So I just said, send me your clips, kid. Sends you clips, you read them, boom, boom, boom. Suddenly, and when he's at UCLA, I think I paid his tuition while he went to UCLA because he wrote so many good stories from us. And Michael Silver, for instance, somebody mentioned Michael Silver's name to me. We looked at him. I met him in San Francisco one night in the bar at the Prescott Hotel. We had a long dinner, and one thing led to the other. Hiring, but that's how it worked. Tellender wrote some freelance story for us over the years. But, you know, Tommy Verducci, we had the opportunity to read. He's brilliant, by the way. We had the opportunity, and I worry about what's his next market. I mean, he needs somewhere to write his stuff, and now SI is out of the business. But he was at Newsday. Peter King was the same way. You know, but when you hired guys, I remember when I hired Peter King, I said, Peter, I'm hiring you to do what you did at Newsday. If you suddenly try to be Dan Jenkins or somebody, you're not going to be here long. Said the same thing to Timmy Rosenfort. You're not Dan Jenkins. You're here to write, you know, informational stuff. That was the balance, I think, we really had. We had great writers, but we also had writers who were really great reporters. And, you know, they're perhaps not the brilliant writers, but they saturated stories with facts that nobody else knew, you know, and that's was the brilliant part of it. What if somebody said, Gary Smith's coming to do a story about you, Jeff? You'd say, oh my God, he's going to tell me things about myself I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what we had. We had a great balance of writers, you know.
One of my favorite stories, when I got to SI in 96, my office mate was a guy named BJ Schechter, a young reporter.
Yeah.
BJ used to fact check Dr. Z, Paul Zimmerman.
Right.
And he told me the first time he had to fact check Paul Zimmerman, he goes, hey, Dr. Z, it's an honor to be working with you. And Dr. Z just goes, I'm not a doctor. He always scared the shit out of me. He just seemed scary and intimidating and rough and old school.
That's what he was. We hired him from the Post. Gil Rogan hired him from the Post because he loved his columns in the Post. He was not a stylist. The key thing he did at every football game was time the national anthem. I mean, he kept a log of every national anthem he ever heard. And he then we had him write a piece one time, if I recall correctly, about national anthems. And the winner was, you know, somebody did it in, you know, 49 seconds or something like that. But Paul was, I mean, there was no grace to his stories. But, you know, if the winning play was something off tackle, he knew the tackle. He talked to the tackle who hit the guard below the knee who did this. I mean, there was the technical football expertise he had was off the charts. And that's why Rogan is the one who called him doctor.
I don't know if you agree with this. I've always made this point. When I was at SI, every now and then someone in the office would say, oh, so-and-so isn't a good writer. And I always thought the worst Sports Illustrated writer would have been one of the best writers of whatever newspaper he worked at. Like even a guy like Dr. Z, who wasn't thought of as a wordsmith, was still an above average American writer.
I don't disagree at all. The bottom line is, I mean, I wrote, I don't know, 30 cover stories for the magazine and covered the golf tour, baseball, pro football, and hockey, of course, or books about hockey. I've written 12 books. No one ever accused me of being a great writer, but I can tell you one thing. I saturated the hell out of stories with facts. So I think there's always a combination, you know, and presented them in a logical, ordered structure. There's a combination. You can be a very good writer for Sports Illustrated if you're a hell of a reporter. But if you're a great writer and don't report, I'm sorry, it doesn't work the other way.
Would you hire people every now and then and they'd be there for a couple months and you'd be like, I fucked up on this one?
Yep. That's happened a few times. And, you know, you ease it on. And, you know, in those days we were floating with money. You'd work out generous departure packages and stuff.
When I tell people about Sports Illustrated and the money they had and the efforts they would take to go for the best stories, it's almost hard to believe in this modern era. What is the craziest amount of money or craziest story when you were running the magazine that you guys pursued?
Oh my God, we had a guy who wrote one fishing story a year and he'd go to Murmansk, he'd go all over the world for that. I don't think he ever caught a fish. You know what I mean? But he and a photographer would go fish for 2 weeks. And, you know, I mean, every year I let somebody else run the magazine for 2 weeks and I go on a quote fact-finding tour. I mean, one year I went all over China, another year I took Eddie Swift with me, went down to South Africa and all those countries. And I mean, we just, you know, I mean, every Sunday during the NFL season, we'd have two or three Learjets stashed around the country to bring the film back. This is before digitalized photography, of course. But, you know, Riley did a story on a wrestling priest one time in Mexico and is gone for a week. I mean, if there was a story somewhere, we did it. You know, you covered the golf tour and you thought you ought to go to the Hawaiian Open, you went. You know what I mean? I mean, I see now in television, I love watching some of these golf tournaments. They say how the great weather is here and so-and-so. And they're back in Stamford, Connecticut in the studio where it's 23 degrees and snowing. You know, that's another thing that's really troubling about sports reportage these days. These broadcasters aren't near the scene of the crime.
You're a New England guy. You started writing for the Boston Globe. I actually have a piece in front of me. It's the first piece I could find with a Mark Mulvoy byline.
Uh-oh.
January 30th, 1961, Boston Globe. BC grads meet C. O'Rourke Jr. by Mark Mulvoy. Johnny Amabile was to be the big man last night at Boston College varsity club dinner, but the son of one of the Eagles' all-time great football players gave Amabile some stiff competition. After Amabile, senior quarterback from New Jersey, was presented with the Tom Scanlon Award, the varsity club trophy, he was introduced to a 6'5" signal caller from Amherst Regional High School named Charlie O'Rourke Jr. Why'd you get into journalism?
My high school yearbook says aspires to become a sports writer, Boston College High School, class of 59. I grew up in Dorchester, which is sort of the Irish Catholic ghetto in Boston. Loved the Red Sox, not the Braves. My brother liked the Braves. I just was a sports fanatic at all times and got a job at the Globe working on the display desk one summer, bringing ads. And I used to go down to the sports office on Saturday, Jerry Nason, the great sports editor. I'd answer the phones for him. And people would ask these stupid questions, bar fights. And I knew the answers. They kept looking. So he hired me. When I was at BC, I was the campus correspondent. I worked nights in the sports department, you know, and just a lot of things. The interesting thing is at BC in those days, we had to wear a jacket and a tie to class. So I'd come over to the Globe. I'd work several nights a week and weekends. And I'd have a jacket and a tie. And somebody would have to go to the airport to meet so-and-so or interview so-and-so. And I'd always be the one that sent because I was dressed more presentably as well. But I always wanted just what I wanted to be, a sports writer. And thank God for the Globe and everything. That's what I became.
And how'd you get to SI?
Well, when I came out of the military, I was in the Air National Guard for 6 months. Anyway, I arrived back in Boston on a snowy Saturday in January of 65. And my father woke me up. I just got to bed about 4 a.m. He says, Mary Snow from Sports Illustrated wants to talk to you. I said, Dad, I don't want a subscription to Sports Illustrated. I had a good life at the Globe. I had covered the Red Sox, traveled around with them. I mean, I was a young bachelor, 22. I'm traveling around the country. It's not a bad life. And so I took the phone, and she invited me down to New York for an interview to be a baseball writer, reporter, or whatever, to start off. Anyway, so I went down a week later and had a nice meeting, and then they offered me a job. And I started off on April 1st of 1965. I was there. Here's how timing works. I was there about 2 months, and Jack Nicklaus was under contract to the magazine to produce stories and what have you. And the guy he was working with at the magazine moved to London, and there I was. You know, do you know anything about golf? I said, hell, I invented the game. I was a caddy all my life and stuff. So off I am down in Florida working with Jack. And then hockey expands in 67, so it becomes a bigger game. And I grew up in hockey in Boston, and I'm the hockey writer. So, I mean, timing really worked out perfectly for me in those areas. You know, the surprise, I think, is I graduated from BC High in 59, and I was nowhere near the top of the class, I can assure you. But I gave the commencement address 50 years later. My wife and I have been very generous to the school. And anyway, there's about 5,000 people at the commencement in my old classmates. And I started my talk by saying, as I look out here today and I see my classmates from the great class of 59, I can assure you that not one of them ever dreamed that they'd be here 50 years after graduation listening to me.
That's awesome.
So it was good.
I'm going to interrupt this because I want to read something that I found. And this is from the December 8th, 1969 issue of Sports Illustrated. It was written by Gary Volk, the publisher of the magazine at the time. And it's a letter from the publisher. I just want to read this real quick. I love this. While musing aloud, which is how he frequently muses, staff writer Mark Mulvoy said not long ago that his idea of the perfect life would be to play golf every afternoon, watch a hockey game at night, and drink with baseball players afterward. But unlike most of us, the difference between Mulvoy's concept of the perfect life and life as he really lives it is slight. Mainly, it is that he must find time in his busy wanderings to write stories. An example, and one that exhibits his talent for getting close to subjects begins on page 36 of this issue. Mulvory came to us nearly 5 years ago from Boston, where he had been a noted student at Boston College while also writing sports for the Boston Globe. We say he was a noted student, noted in quotes, because that is how Mulvory himself sees it. I majored in general business, which was very unusual up there. They arranged a special set of courses for me where I explained that I didn't have time to go to class and cover sports simultaneously, he says. His education admirably suited his needs. One reason Mulvory gets along so well with athletes is that in his temperament and his life, he stays closely resembled to the people he writes about. He's tall, energetic, and effusive, and he was always turned out like one of our clothing ads. The latest in sporting garments appear in him before they arrive in store windows. This earned him a reputation as the Adolf Menjo of First Avenue a couple of years ago when he was a bachelor on his New York's East Side. With unflailing instinct, Mulvory's first choice of an apartment upon landing in Manhattan was a building on 65th Street that has become known as the original Stuzu. He immediately invited a number of his Red Sox friends to a housewarming where they met a few score of hundreds of airline stewardess who lived in the building. The party was such a success that one prominent Red Soxer was fined $1,000 by the club for failure to keep an appointment with the New York Yankees. The late Boston general manager, Mike Higgins, grabbed Mulvory by the throat and growled, "What are you trying to do to us, kids? Ruin my team?" Undaunted, Mulvory forges ahead at a pace that carries him 100,000 miles per year and makes his byline a frequent one of our pages. He's written primarily about baseball, golf, and ice hockey. He's prepared instructionals on hockey with Toe Blake and on golf with Jack Nicklaus. Mark may have slowed down somewhat lately. He now has a wife, a baby daughter named Kelly, and a mortgage on a house in Stamford, Connecticut. But he still counts his miles by the thousands and is ever alert to the story. He met this week's subject at a dinner party, interviewed him on a golf course, and was talked into making his first football bet. Mark won. We don't urge that you take up betting, but do read what our own itinerant sportsman has found out about the subject.
That was a story about my friend Charlie Moore. Charlie was he's a member of Augusta and everywhere else. But he was a big bettor. And I didn't know that he was a member of my club. We played golf. And I said, "What are you doing with this?" He says, "I sit by and bet all these colors." So I went and spent a weekend with him. I mean, he'd bet the first half score, quarter, but this is in a day before gambling, was as pervasive as it is now. And I wrote the story. I then went to his wedding. His wife's family went ballistic when they found out that he was such a gambler. But he and Susie been married now. I don't know. He got married the day, because I was at the wedding, the day before the Bruins lost Game 7 to the Canadians in 1971 in Boston. I was at the reception that night in Boston and stayed for the game the next day. So that worked out very well. Let me say one other thing. We took on Pete Rose, and Pete Rose isn't in the Hall of Fame. People would tell you mainly because of the great investigative work we did. I mean, we had a record of every bet the guy ever made, let's face it. But what's going on in sports with gambling to me is sickening. I'm sorry. I mean, you can't tell me that people aren't betting under different names with bookies in obscure places. And it's already happened in a lot of places. The ads for gambling. And I know personally a family member on my wife's side, a kid who developed such a gambling problem while in college, he's going to Gamblers Anonymous, and he ran up a massive debt of like $65,000. That's pretty tough when you're a college student betting on things. And this whole pervasive betting attention, and now you've got a casino bought the Dallas basketball team, the Mavericks. I mean, I don't know where it's going to end, but I've told the commissioners that Adam Silver used to babysit for us, so he and I are very good friends, and Rye and Roger, and I said, "This is your next big scandal in sports, like it or not."
Adam Silver used to babysit for you?
Yeah, he grew up in Rye, and he was always around, and he's a great kid, Adam.
I agree with you 1,000,000% on gambling. And I also think one thing that has really happened in American society that is sad, heaven forbid anyone just watch a football game because it's fun. You know what I mean? Like, heaven forbid I sit down. I don't care about the Browns or the Broncos, but heaven forbid I just watch the fucking Browns-Broncos game because I enjoy football. Why does everyone have to have a bet on everything?
Oh, bet on this play. It's a joke. I mean, to me, it's the disgusting part of American sports. But it consumes all sports. No matter hockey, they're betting on half a puck, this and that. I mean, oh, my God, where does it end? The ads and the casinos. I mean, look at everything. The Super Bowl's in Vegas this year. Everything is now revolves around Vegas.
Yep.
And, what can I say? What we did on Pete Rose was right at the time. I don't know that what Pete Rose did is any different than what a lot of people are doing now. Pete was such a jerk. Sandy Koufax lives down the street here for me here in Vero. And he's, you know, Sandy's, you know, he's not elusive, but he's, but I can tell you that the Sandy Koufax is the world. If he ever get in the Hall of Fame, they'd never go. I mean, because forget the gambling part. He was such a, you know, the way he handled everything was just, he's a, I don't know what the right word for it. I do, but I don't want to say it.
I would say asshole, but you can go with that.
That's a good one.
April 3rd, 1989, Pete Rose is on the cover of Sports Illustrated. It's Under Siege, Pete Rose. Was there any, I know you said there's no trepidation. When you're going hard after a major, major American iconic figure like Pete Rose, is there any sort of, well, we have to be really careful about not getting sued. We have to be really careful about this, blah, blah, blah. This might turn off a lot of people. Is there any of that with you or none?
Tell me, I don't think in of the 500-600 stories issues, I don't think we ever sued during my days about anything. I mean, every story went through a vetting process with lawyers. Every story at Time Inc. It wasn't just our, you know, our stories, but Time Magazine and people, lawyers, you know, with, I mean, if they raised four or five flags, we had to justify our reporting. And we could just, let me tell you, when you have the people like Armin Katayan and that group reporting for you, you know what? You get pretty, you know, those guys. I mean, these are the best of the best. You know, the diligence, Jill Lieber and these people, the diligence they did on stories. Oh my God. It was to their eternal credit. Marty Dardis, you know, when we had the Don Reese piece, he and I worked on that morning, noon and night, you know, the white cover, you know, and cocaine that Roselle wouldn't talk to me for 2 years. And he was a neighbor of mine. We'd have dinner with our wives and he wouldn't talk. And all of a sudden, he called me 2 years later and he said, you know, I couldn't, you know, I said, I know Joe Brown said you weren't talking to me. He said, well, I want to thank you because in all the years before Reese, we had about a dozen players avail themselves, whatever drug programs we had in place. Since then, the number's in the hundreds. So that was an eye opener to the league is what it amounted to.
I just want to say that cover, June 14th, 1982, and it was an NFL player named Don Reese.
Right.
Talking about using cocaine and how prevalent cocaine was in the NFL. For me, 10 years old was a terrifying story. Terrifying. Like, oh my God, everyone's a drug addict.
But Jeff, who's doing those stories now? Nobody.
Nobody.
That's the problem. Nobody's doing the Pete Rose stories. Nobody's doing Don Reese. I put the quarterback from Oklahoma on the cover in the orange prison jumpsuit. I mean, these, the academic abuses that throughout colleges, I mean, I'm laughing at the colleges. Some kid yesterday I read is going to get his 9th year of eligibility somewhere. 9 years of college eligibility to play sports. I mean, what in God's name is going on here? 9 years.
I just want to say the cover you're referring to, which is very interesting. The headline was "You Reap What You Sow." And it was Charles Thompson, the Oklahoma quarterback. Right. And you literally have him being handcuffed and put in a police car. And it says how Barry Switzer's Sooners terrorized their campus. Did you get backlash from that?
Yeah, the governor. I think governor was named David Boren. Yeah, he made a big stink about it. But what happened about those things is, you know, usually somebody would talk to you and you'd explain something. Well, this and that. And then they said, then they'd do their diligence and they'd shut up. You know what I mean? Yep. Is what it amounts, you know, because for everything you printed, you probably had three or four other factoidal tidbits or pieces of information to sustain even to a greater length the story.
I'm required to ask this because I ask of everyone who appears in my podcast, and I feel like you have some answers in you. In your career, what was the angriest someone was at you?
Probably Michael Jordan, putting him on the cover that time. I know I put Gary Nicklaus on the cover once because we lost, you know, I lost a cover one Sunday in July or whatever year it was. So I put Gary Nicklaus on the cover. We had a story on him. Barbara, his mother, and I love Barbara. She's a dear friend. She was mad because I think, too much pressure on the high school kid, but inside there was a picture of Gary and his then girlfriend on a boat and she had a skimpy bikini on. I think that bothered Barbara. Jack actually loved the cover, the fact that he was on the cover. I know that, but that was a David Stern. Never like I put the cover that time, why the NHL's hot and the NBA's not. David went nuts. I was a hockey guy. I gave hockey more coverage than they probably should have gotten, but yeah, I liked hockey. You know, when you have to make those decisions to fill a page, I want to do a hockey story.
Wait, so when people were mad at you, when a David Stern or Pete Rozelle or whoever was mad at you and they were calling you, were you at all nervous or were you just like, bring it? I'm here.
Bring it. You know, we were, you know, we all, it's social, that Stern didn't socialize with Stern, but Adam and I obviously, you know, knew each other pretty well. And I think that Adam probably mollified David at times and calmed him down. But Pete and I, you know, we'd known each other for a long time. And that was, you know, talk those things out. I mean, Uberoth, there was nothing about Uberoth. Faye Vincent, who lives around the corner from me down here in, at John's Island, but I never had a problem with those guys. You know what I mean? Oh, you had some with individual clubs, Ed Snyder, the Snyders, the Flyers, when I was writing, get mad because of what we were calling as Flyers, you know, the Broad Street Bullies, but, you know, but then they are, you know, and stuff like that. And you talk it out. I'll tell you what I did do. One of the best stories I ever wrote was about Willie Mays in 1967. I remember the first paragraph talking about his eyes with like road maps from San Jose to Santa Cruz or something like that. And Willie was furious at the end of the story. Because basically, in the story I mentioned, because I had done the research, he never faced in those days the Drysdales, never faced the Seavers and the Gibsons. You know, he had lumbago or something that day, and but would come back. And so I wrote a story saying that Willie, I had a great quote from Gene Mark. I realized Gene said, "What are you doing out here?" I said, "I'm doing a piece on Willie." He says, "I need a quote." He says, "Willie Mays ain't Willie Mays four times a game anymore. But that one time." Anyway, I wrote the story. And Willie was BS. So anytime I hear something like, I'd immediately get on a plane and go somewhere where they might be to hang around a batting cage and put it up, walk onto the batting cage. I think it was in Philly. And Willie McCovey, who was a great guy, Willie comes up to me and says, "Don't worry about anything. We got your back." That was the truth, you know? And never heard another word from Willie, you know?
I just want to say, Mark, August 7th, 1967, "Say Hey No More."
Say Hey No More.
Sick. "An aging Willie Mays struggles to finish a season that has already lasted too long." Your lead was, "Sitting there in the Giants clubhouse in Candlestick Park, Willie Mays looked old and sick. His eyes were like roadmaps, Route 1 from San Francisco to Santa Cruz, and the circles beneath them said that Willie does not sleep too well at night anymore. His voice was somewhat muffled and restrained. The vigorous say hey is only a memory. There still was an hour before the start of the game with the Philadelphia Phillies, and most of the Giants were shooting pool in the back room or signing baseballs or reading mail. But Mays sat in his locker cubicle, hunched on a four-legged stool. These kid pitchers," Willie was saying, "they're all so big and strong and throw the ball so hard they make you feel old too soon." It's really good.
Yeah, no, I wrote one about Cha-Cha Cepeda, I think, 2 weeks before, 2 weeks after. I thought that I love writing baseball because I used to love baseball. I like watching baseball for one thing, because I like the pace of it. Hockey's become a great hockey. Too many teams now play the same way and they're all the same size and everything. But what I love about baseball is being with maybe knowing the managers so well and having dinner with them and talking to them about strategy. One of my best manager stories in spring training in Palm Springs, I used to always play golf with Bill Rigney. You know, we play nine holes after or whatever it might be. And he loved golf. And so I'm in Fenway Park in 66 or seven, whatever year it was. And, I'm watching his batting practice. He's got Dick Stewart, Leroy. He's got a whole bunch of guys, you know, big old pine. No, they're all probably hung over and they can't hit the wall. And I said, "Jesus, you know, hitting it over the wall is the easiest thing in the world, Rig." He says, "Man, you try." I said, "Give me five swings. I'll hit it over four times." "Right?" Yeah. I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll bet 100. He said, "You got it." I said, "Let me get my stuff." I go to my car and I get my 7-iron. I bring in five golf balls. I hit the first three over the left field wall. He gave me the 100.
That's awesome.
I mean, you did. You know, that's what I'm talking about, too. We did those things in the old days. You know, we had a camaraderie. We had a kinship, a fellowship. We talked to them. We flew on planes with them. We knew them. You know, you do a story with a guy. I mean, I remember before a big playoff game in Baltimore one year, I was doing the Colts and the Steelers one year. And I'm down, and Burt Jones is the quarterback. And I said to Burt, "Can we have lunch?" He says, "Oh, it's after practice Saturday, the day before the game." So I met his fiance, then that was wife. Her name was Danny Dupuy. I'll never forget. She had a pair of jeans on, and the label on the back of the jeans was French dressing, which I mentioned in my story. But I had a great, I mean, here it is the day before a game. Can you imagine talking to Tom Brady or anybody the day before a playoff game? Oh, my God.
Don't you think something changed where the importance dynamic, like back in the day, if William Knack was coming to town, he mattered.
It was a big event.
It was an event. And nowadays, the balance between athlete and reporter is just the, you know, it's a one-sided.
It doesn't exist. I'll tell you, I was on the first trip I ever made with the Red Sox in 63. We were flying a DC-6B to Kansas City at about 2 miles an hour, 6 hours from New York, when we had played a Sunday doubleheader. And I was sitting in one room, and across from me is Charlie Schilling, the second baseman. We called him Howdy. And Howdy says to me, "Hey, Bush, what do you make?" I said, "I don't know, it's 5,500 or something, you know. Hey, I'm 22 years old," or whatever I was, out of school, 23, out of college, traveling with the Red Sox. I mean, it's not a bad life, huh? And I said, "Well, what do you make?" He says, "Well, $6,500, major league minimum." Well, the difference between us was $1,000. Now the writer makes whatever, and the second baseman makes $17,400. You know, so that economic gulf has really created, a social gap too between the two. It puts an end to it.
Let me ask you a final question. Some kid at BC, you come in, you talk to BC, and the kid writes for the student newspaper at Boston College. "I really want to be a journalist. Is it worth pursuing?" What do you tell him?
I say, it's like I tell all these young kid golf pros. I said, you got to look at ancillary opportunities within the interest. I said, because you look at newspapers, I mean, the Times doesn't have a sports section. Newspapers, the Montreal Gazette, goes to bed every day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as Michael Farber would tell you. You know, I hate to tell you, but the newspapers are on their way out big time, and I don't know what's going to replace them. And, I mean, we all had deals. I mean, we had contracts, we had salaries, we had medical benefits, we had, retirement plans and everything. None of that exists anymore. So, I mean, I tell these young golf pros to, instead of unpacking clubs from somebody's car until you're 28 and then you go teach lessons and stuff like that, do something with your life that has longer term, better long term benefits for you. That's all. I think it's tough.
It must really, as a guy who loves journalism so much and made his career out of journalism,
kills you.
It must break your heart.
It does. It breaks my heart. What happened at SI this week, it didn't break my heart because it was broken earlier when these arenas and all these other people, use the magazine, not for what we use the magazine, to disseminate great stories with great writers and entertain the public. But really, is I don't even know what it was. You know what I mean? I haven't read the magazine in years. The only thing I read two writers, Pat Forty, whom I don't know, and Tommy Verducci. That's it. And Tom, I don't think Tom's written this winter. I may be wrong.
It's the worst. Well, Mark, I appreciate you doing this. I am a huge, huge admirer. And, consider my time at SI, which was glorious, sort of an extension of what you set up there. So I really appreciate you, and I thank you for taking the time to do this.
I've enjoyed it immensely, and I've always admired your work, and I do wish that you'd come along 10 years earlier, because we'd have had a hell of a lot of fun.
I want to thank today's guest, Mark Mulvoy, for joining me on Two Riders Sing and Yang. Do yourself a favor and go to the SI Vault and check out all the work Mark is responsible for. It's a lesson in sports history. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.